everyone who loves books, this is Read on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews and author interviews. I'm your host Red Sail, and this week we'll be opening our satchels and getting out some great contemporary children's books. Anjali Q. Ralph introduces us to the boy at the back of the class.
They discover that the boy is actually a refugee and go on this amazing adventure to try and reunite him with his family.
Anthony McGowan takes us out onto the moors in a snowstorm in his new novel, Lark.
Down in the valleys where they are, it's, you know, just a normal kind of late winter day, all fine. But once they hit those heights, they realise that things have turned a bit nasty.
And we go behind the scenes to find out how RNIB is celebrating World Book Day.
Everybody else in the sighted community has to pay £1 for their book. We give ours away for free.
That's all coming up on today's Read On. Children's fiction has never shied away from tackling the big issues. And my first guest has written about one of today's most emotive. Anjali Q. Ralph's novel, The Boy at the Back of the Class, is the story of Ahmet, a 10-year-old refugee from Syria who is the new boy at a school in London. Written from the point of view of one of his classmates, a little girl who's determined to make friends with Ahmet and give him a sense of belonging, it's poignant, funny, and utterly unforgettable. And I'm delighted to be joined by the book's author. Anjali Ralph, welcome to Read On.
Hello, Red. Hi. Such an honour to be here.
Well, thank you very much for coming in. So, can you introduce us to The Boy at the Back of the Class?
Sure. So, The Boy at the Back of the Class is a story about a young narrator who goes to a school, a London school, and one day a very strange young boy happens to walk in. And they're absolutely fascinated by why this boy is quiet and pale and withdrawn and sits at the back of the class. And they discover that the boy is actually a refugee and go on this amazing adventure to try and reunite him with his family.
And Ahmed, the refugee boy, is very quiet and withdrawn. Mm. And you make the point that actually in the absence of knowledge, rumours start to spread. So people are suspicious of him because he's not very forthcoming. And there are reasons for that, which it's only through the unnamed narrator and her friend's determination to interact with him as friends that we find out.
Yeah.
And those rumours are quite unpleasant, but not as unpleasant as actually some of the reasons why Ahmed is so quiet.
Yeah, absolutely. And the rumours are, I think it's a very natural thing to do when you don't know about someone, you guess stories about them. The unpleasant side of rumours is it can be quite nasty. So in the book, there are rumours that he might have a disease. And the fact that Ahmed doesn't speak English is another kind of layer of mystery for the children in the book. And I think the nastiness that can come with suspicions and fears are shown in the book to have had a grounding in the adult world that they're surrounded by and the rumours that kind of fly out from certain words that children don't really understand. So there's also a double battle, if you like. So for Ahmet, he has to battle not just what he's been through and his experiences as a refugee, but also trying to make others understand who he is and where he has come from and why it is that he needs time and space to gather himself and become himself again.
And it's told from the point of view of a 9.5-year-old girl in very simple and yet very, very effective language. And I was wondering if that's why you felt that you needed to approach this global problem of refugees through the eyes of children, because it strips back the language.
Absolutely. So when I had a kind of meeting with my agent and she suggested that I start writing about the refugee crisis, my first instinct was to try and write an adult novel about it from the perspective of women who've been through it, because that's who I work with in Calais and Dunkirk. But I very quickly realised that actually it's children who have the most questions for me when I return from my journeys. It's they who are the most open-minded. And I think anybody with children or who work with children will understand just how razor-sharp their perception is. So it became the easiest thing in the world to sit down and write this book from the perspective of a child, especially since I'm surrounded by by my nephews and nieces who have 1,000 questions about this so-called crisis. And I wanted to create something that they could turn to get some of those answers, because I don't think they really get it from the adult world, or we dismiss their questions very easily, or we tell them, you know, something they can deal with when they're older. But actually, I think children have a very keen idea of what's going on. They want to know. And I think by stripping back the language and questioning what it is we're hearing, which is what children do all the time, we can really get to the heart of this refugee crisis, which is human beings in need. And I think children really latch onto that quite beautifully.
There's a wonderful and very resonant line at the beginning of the book with grown-ups always coming up with long words for simple things. And for me, that just pulsed all the way through the book. And you use that as a starting off point for actually simplifying the words that are used to describe people who have travelled from one place to another and what reasons they had to do so. So you unpick what the difference between a refugee mm-hmm. and a migrant mm-hmm. and an immigrant are. Could you do that for the listeners?
Absolutely. It's one of the most frustrating things that I find when we open up a newspaper or we're listening to the radio and we hear the term economic migrants, or these migrants have been coming to the shores of the UK, or immigrants are trying to get in. But there's a huge difference, the global difference between a refugee, a migrant and an immigrant. Now, migrants and immigrants have a choice. They choose to move. It may be for a new job. It may be they want to go to a different country to live in. It may be they've fallen in love and want to move for that. But if you're in a war zone, if you're facing environmental destitution, if you're being politically persecuted, you have no choice. And that's what makes a refugee so much more different than a migrant or an immigrant. You don't have a choice in why it is you're moving. You don't have a choice as to where it is you're going. You might be trying to reunite with family, but at the end of the day, your home is no longer safe enough for you to stay. And those terminologies that we use so flippantly sometimes, it can really have an impact on, you know, how we view refugees and how we view their purposes for moving and for giving up everything, for putting themselves at risk at sea, or, you know, however it is they're travelling, for putting their children at risk. And I think we really do need to be very careful of the words we use and try and understand that actually there's massive difference between similar sounding words and what they're deemed to mean by the adult world, I suppose. So I'm really keen for children to understand that refugees have no choice in what they're having to do. They're having to give up everything, whereas migrants and immigrants have a huge choice as to what it is that they are doing with their lives and their monies and their homes. And we need to separate those two kind of areas of labelling peoples.
And literacy is absolutely at the heart of this book, understanding what words mean and learning to understand as well. Your nameless heroine is surrounded by books. Her mum is a librarian. They don't have much, but they do have access to books. She's rather addicted to Tintin, which I think many of us growing up were. Yeah. And her mum comes up with a wonderful saying, which is, the best books leave you with more questions than answers. And that's the fun bit, finding some answers for yourself.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And that's the kind of book that you've written. In fact, it ends with 7 questions for the reader, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Yeah. So I want this to be a jumping off ground. I want this story to get people and children and their parents and anybody else they're surrounded by to get discussions going about refugees and what they're seeing in the papers and have those discussions. And I think the most lovely thing that I've been hearing since the book came out is responses from grandparents who, especially Jewish grandparents, who've said, my children have never really asked me what it was like for me coming to the UK. But for the first time, they're coming back and asking me these questions. It's been lovely to have those discussions. So I think it's opening up very difficult areas of thought. And if it's doing that, then that makes me incredibly happy. Yeah. So, and there's 7 questions at the back. They're there to kind of help along the process of not being afraid to ask yourself questions and not being afraid of the answers either.
And actually realising that there, but for the happy situation that we live in the UK, we too could become refugees. Mm-hmm. What 3 things would we take with us if we had to leave our homes tomorrow? It's a wonderful way of making people focus on being empathetic.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. I think when it comes to the refugee crisis or any kind of humanitarian crisis where you're faced with endless faces that you will not know the names of, that you may never meet, it's very easy to switch the channel, it's very easy to switch off, because there's this term called compassion fatigue, where you're just so overwhelmed by bad news, by horrible things happening, that you can't actually humanize the faces that you're seeing or humanize the names that you're hearing. And that's absolutely fine in one way, because it's a way of self-defense, it's a way of continuing in your own world without going crazy. But in another way, we have to try and focus in on those faces that we can get to know, that we can help and reach out to. And I think if we can start to do that just on a one-to-one basis, I think one of the biggest things that I hear when I'm going out to the refugee camps, etc., is it feels like nothing. You're just taking out a tent and some sleeping bags. What's that going to do? And my answer is always, if you can help just one person that day, then that's one person helped. We can do this one by one. It doesn't have to be in the millions and thousands, because that's beyond anybody's capacity, but you can do the one-on-one. So by empathizing, by understanding, by not being afraid to ask questions of ourselves and the faces that we're seeing, I'm hoping that, yes, we'll have some, I don't know, some grain of non-fear to ask and take forward our actions.
And also, by buying the book, we are also helping the refugees, because I believe you're donating a proportion of the royalties to charities that help.
Absolutely. So I work with a number of charities in Calais and Dunkirk who are receiving no help whatsoever. It's absolutely phenomenal, the human beings on the ground. It's so-called ordinary citizens like you and I who go out every weekend. Some have given up their lives, some have given up their studies to, you know, have stayed out there for years, and they desperately need help. So a proportion of the books will be going towards my works with them, and hopefully trying to find solutions as well.
Now, we're dealing with very weighty issues, and I hope the listeners will be able to hear it in your voice. You have a great sense of fun, and it is very, very entertaining, fun book that I, as a grown-up, thoroughly enjoyed reading.
Oh, I'm so glad. Thank you.
You really enjoy turning people's perceptions on their heads. I mean, there are really nice drivers of black cabs in this book, and the people who you suspect might not be particularly nice do turn out to be really lovely. You clearly had great fun writing the book.
Absolutely. So I live in the East End of London. I have done for most of my life. And I've always been surprised at how the most unexpected people can come forward in times of need or help. So I have, for example, a neighbour who's a bus driver, and he's the most quietest person you'll ever see. I have another man on my road who's a road sweep. He sweeps the road every morning. He's got tattoos all the way up his arm. You'd never think that he would donate towards the refugee crisis, etc. But all of them are part of my works and my world. And I wanted to get people thinking not just about people we don't speak to, but also who we do speak to and who we do see every day, and to never underestimate the human being in front of you and the capacity to do something amazing. So it shocks me every day in my life, and I wanted that to come across in the book, and I'm so glad if it has, so thank you.
Are you working on another book?
Yes, I am. It's going to be called The Star Outside My Window, and it's about a young girl who goes on the hunt for her mother's star after something quite horrible has happened. And it features the Royal Observatory in Greenwich, which is where I was hanging out all day yesterday asking a million questions. But we'll see. I think it's going to come out in October, hopefully, if I can stick to schedule.
And that'll be, again, for the preteen market?
Or... yeah, for middle grade, so 9+, yeah.
And the audiobook is an absolute delight. Imogen Wilde is a terrific narrator. Did you have anything to do with choosing her?
Oh, she's absolutely fantastic. So I got given by my publishers some names and some recordings of different voices. And her one, I think my agent actually said, I think she's just going to be phenomenal. And I absolutely agreed straight away. And she has this amazing raspiness in her voice. And because the book also tries to hide the gender in some ways, I thought it would be a perfect fit. And I didn't want it to be too polished, kind of, you know, very posh voice. I wanted it to be someone that could speak to the children and who they would listen to. So she was absolutely fantastic.
You must be delighted that as an audiobook, it's reaching an audience of print disabled people who might not otherwise get to read the book.
Absolutely.
Have you got any links to sight loss yourself within your own family?
So my grandfather actually became partially blind before he died a few years ago. And I have a deaf nephew and niece who are also having sight problems now because they have got a degenerative disease. So we're very aware of things that we can do as a family to help them. And it's a huge learning curve as well. So it's a gradual thing for me. I never had any people who were, or children who were experiencing sight loss in my school. So it's not something that we were brought up with, which I think is something that we need to tackle as well on a far wider scale. But on the family front, yes, in a very gentle way, I would say. It's not hit us very hard, but it's not something I live with daily, but it's something that I'm very aware of and that we're trying to learn to help with regards to my nephews and nieces.
Well, it did make me wish that someone would approach a child with sight loss at the back of the class in the same way that you have approached Ahmed and his story as a refugee. But who knows? Maybe a project for the future.
Hopefully so, yes.
Well, thank you so much for writing an amazing book that I can't recommend enough, and for coming into the Read On studios and sharing the story with us.
It's my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, for reading it as well. That's just the most wonderful thing to hear. Thank you.
The Boy at the Back of the Class is available commercially in print, ebook, and as an audiobook. Narrated brilliantly by Imogen Wilde.
After whispering for a few more seconds with Mrs. Khan, Mrs. Sanders left the classroom. We expected Mrs. Khan to say something, but she seemed to be waiting, so we waited too. It was all very serious and exciting. But before we could start guessing about what was going on, Mrs. Sanders came back, and this time she wasn't alone. Standing behind her was a boy. A boy none of us had ever seen before. He had short dark hair and large eyes that hardly blinked and smooth pale skin. "Everyone," said Mrs. Khan as the boy went and stood next to her, "this is Ahmed and he'll be joining our class from today. He's just moved to London and is new to the school, so I hope you'll all do your very best to make him feel welcome." We all watched in silence as Mrs. Sanders led him to the empty chair. I felt sorry for him because I knew he wouldn't like sitting next to Clarissa very much. She still missed Dina, and everyone knew she hated boys. She says they're stupid and smell. I think it must be one of the worst things in the world to be new to a place and have to sit with people you don't know, especially people that stare and scowl at you like Clarissa was doing. I made a secret promise to myself right there and then that I would be friends with the new boy. I happened to have some lemon sherbets in my bag that morning, and I thought I would try and give him one at break time. And I would ask Josie and Tom and Michael if they would be his friends too. After all, having four new friends would be much better than having none, especially for a boy who looked as scared and sad as the one now sitting at the back of our class.
Imogen Wilde narrating The Boy at the Back of the Class, written by my guest today, Anjali Q. Ralph. And Anjali will be back at the end of the show to share the books of her life.
RNIB Talking Books provides more than 1 million audiobooks every year to people with sight loss and is now completely free for all blind and partially sighted people in the UK. The RNIB library is the largest of its kind in Europe and offers a wide range of fiction and non-fiction titles, which readers can access on CD, on USB, or as a digital download. The RNIB library also caters for adults and children in both Braille and giant print, so that you can listen how you choose, whether at home or on the go. To find out more about the RNIB library or to sign up for your free membership, call the RNIB helpline on 0303 123 9999 or visit www.rnib.org.uk/library.
Hello, I'm Ray Sawyer. I've been reading for the RNIB Talking Books for 25 years now. My first book was Coming From Behind by Howard Jacobson, but the one I think I enjoyed most was Writing Home by Alan Bennett. Not just because it's wonderful writing, but although not officially an autobiography, you've got a sense of his life as all his selections of writings were put in chronological order. I particularly like The Lady in the Van. The Talking Book studios, as now, were very close to where Alan Bennett lived, and I was able to walk up and actually see the driveway and the house in which the lady lived for 25 years. And quite by chance, Alan Bennett was sitting on his front step reading The Guardian when I turned up.
This van, there were to be three others in the course of the next 20 years, was originally brown. But by the time it had reached the Crescent, it had been given a coat of yellow. Miss S. was fond of yellow. "It's the papal colour." and was never content to leave her vehicles long in their original trim. Sooner or later she could be seen moving slowly round her immobile home, thoughtfully touching up the rust from a tiny tin of primrose paint, looking, in her long dress and sun hat, much as Vanessa Bell would have looked had she gone in for painting Bedford vans. Miss S. never appreciated the difference between car enamel and ordinary gloss paint, and even this she never bothered to mix. The result was that all her vehicles ended up looking as if they'd been given a coat of badly made custard or plastered with scrambled egg. Still, there were few occasions on which one saw Miss Shepherd genuinely happy, and one of them was when she was putting paint on.
I love doing the talking books because, well, you get to play parts that you'd never get to play in real life. In fact, doing a book is a bit like doing a one-man show, only one that's 25 hours long.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
You're listening to Read On, RNIB Connect Radio's weekly compendium of the best in books and reading. Still to come in today's show, we'll hear about the brilliant titles on offer free from the RNIB Library for 2019's World Book Day. Last year, Anthony McGowan's novella Rook was shortlisted for the Silip Carnegie Prize. After being interviewed for Read On, he talked to his publishers Barrington Stoke and not only donated all three books in the series, Brock, Pike and Rook, to the RNIB Library, but also came in and narrated the talking book versions himself. Lark, the fourth and final book in the series, has just been published to great acclaim, and Anthony came back to the studio to tell me all about it. Anthony McGowan, welcome back to the Read On studio.
It's nice to be here again.
Well, Lark picks up where Rook ended off. Nikki and Kenny are a couple of months on from the end of the last book, and they go out onto the moors to kind of clear their heads, don't they?
That's right, yes. They've got a lot happening at home. Not bad things for a change. Their mother, who left them when they were quite small, is going to come and visit from Canada. So they're in a bit of a frenzy about that. And also, Nicky's got some emotional problems with his girlfriend. So they decide to leave their small town and hit the moors.
And it doesn't quite go to plan.
No, does it ever? If it goes to plan, there's no book.
Well, as any of us who've been up onto the Yorkshire Moors knows, the weather can change very, very quickly. And because they're running a bit late and the weather does change, they get caught in a snowstorm.
Yes, and they're not very well prepared. They kind of go out in their normal everyday clothes, their trainers, their jeans, their light jackets, because down in the valleys where they are, it's, you know, just a normal kind of late winter day, all fine. But once they hit those heights, they realise that things have turned a bit nasty.
They're out there with their dog as well.
Yes.
And yet again, we see the very best side of Nicky. He is a teenage carer for his brother who's got learning difficulties. Mm-hmm. And he is an incredibly kind, caring young man who also has to put up with an awful lot of his own problems.
Yes. I suppose, well, I don't know if I need to explain some of the backstory in the first three books to get to here, but it's now the fourth book in the trilogy, as I always say. And the first one, the family is in a terrible state. Their mother's left, their father's got in trouble with the police, he's got alcohol problems, and it leaves the two boys pretty much on their own. There's Nicky, who's the younger brother, and Kenny, who's the older one with the learning difficulties. And Nicky, he lives really just to look after his brother. There's not very much else in his life. And so that relationship actually is a key thing throughout all the books. But gradually their family background improves a little bit until by the point we're at Lark, they're in a relatively stable home background. Their father's got a nice new girlfriend who helps sort them out. And I suppose the more the extraordinary problems in Nicky's life diminish, the more then the normal teenage problems come to the fore. Problems with bullying and with early romance. But also, as the books develop, is a kind of codependency between Nicky and Kenny, that Kenny obviously needs his kid brother, but Nicky also needs Kenny in a way. And Kenny becomes more independent as the stories go on. He's got his own kind of life, which again, Nicky has to come to terms with. So all those things have come to a boil in the fourth in Lark.
And you're giving voice to a situation that a lot of working class kids find themselves in,
when they've got broken homes, when there are problems and no work and learning difficulties. I can't really think of any other writer who's doing that at the moment. Is it something that's very close to your heart?
Well, it is. I mean, there are a couple. My friend Phil Earle wrote a series of really brilliant YA books, Being Billy and a few others, in there, all kind of set in the north of England, which got a similar kind of gritty, realistic background. So there are a few. But I suppose I've thought for a while that nearly always there's a kind of tendency towards only seeing middle-class people as interesting, both in the wider fiction and also in YA. Or the way you make YA interesting is by then making it fantasy or kind of strange in some other way. I suppose what I wanted to do was to, A, put forward working-class characters, but, B, make their lives interesting in a realistic way, because everyday life is, in fact, full of adventure and mystery and strangeness and danger often. So that was the kind of thing I was trying to do. And also, I think I said to you last time when we were speaking that a big influence on me was A Kestrel for a Knave, later filmed as Kes by Barry Hines. And I had this experience of being in a classroom in a Leeds comprehensive full of just ordinary kids reading through the text. And then one of the kids suddenly put his hand up and said, Miss, this is us. And that kind of moment of recognition of the reader realising that someone like him or she is allowed to be in a book at all was very important to me.
And as with Kes, you really ground your story in the nature that surrounds these mining villages.
Yeah.
And I think when I was reading the books, I definitely felt that nature is there to prove that life is messy and imperfect, and there isn't a great perfection in life that we should all be striving to. Actually, we have to problem solve as and when those problems come up. That's what we have to learn from nature.
I can only nod. That's very well put.
And at the centre of these books is also that whilst Nicky is caring for Kenny, both boys end up caring for injured animals, a badger in the first book, Brock. There's a lovely line where Nicky says, to be honest, I think that we got more out of caring for the animals than they got from us caring for them.
Yes, well, I think the animals in Brock and Rook help the family to heal in particular. They kind of bring the family together. I suppose that the animal element in both Pike and Lark is more symbolic. So there isn't particularly an animal cared for in Lark. The basic story is that the boys get lost on the moors, things spiral down, that Nicky breaks his ankle, they get trapped in this gully. There's a strong suspicion that they don't all survive, all three of them, and there's various moments of kind of peril. And the Lark, I suppose, becomes a symbol for freedom and escape towards the end of it. So it's a more kind of symbolic creature in this story, as well as the double meaning of it being a lark, a kind of a meant to be a fun expedition for them.
It's a real tearjerker. Did you set out to
cynically make
to upset
the
us? Yes.
I wanted to turn the emotion up to 11, I suppose, in this book. But both the danger... So I wanted it to be a genuinely gripping adventure story in a way that perhaps the other ones aren't. The other ones are kind of more grounded in realism. This one was meant to be genuinely exciting, and you're meant to be that sensation that we have that when we're really enjoying, but when you can't turn the pages quickly enough. But I also then wanted to heighten the emotion. So there's a couple of, I suppose, slightly dishonest moments where I make the reader think that something terrible's happened. And then what's meant to be a big emotional moment, or two big emotional moments towards the end. But yes, I did have this ambition to make my wife cry. She'd always be my first reader. And so I left her with the manuscript and came back a couple of hours later. And blissfully, her face was soaking wet and her eyes were red. So I thought, OK, I've succeeded.
And you say that it's the final book in the series. I've heard authors say that before. It's not always the case. Can I trust you?
Well, I think so. I mean, certainly the whole arc of the lives of the characters is finished with that one. I suppose that in theory I could go back and fill in some more detail in that arc, but there's nothing to happen after this, if you know what I mean, chronologically. It depends how successful it is, I suppose. I think this is it now. The quartet is complete.
And we're talking just before World Book Day, and UNESCO obviously wants to make books available to every child and young person in the world. Your books were specially written for children who have difficulties with reading, whether it's dyslexia or whatever, and you and your publisher Barrington Stoke have made them accessible also to the RNIB. You clearly feel very strongly that books and reading should be made accessible to everyone.
Yes, I mean, it was obviously a key part of my own upbringing in this small Yorkshire town where I sort of lived in our local library, and that was a lifeline for me. So, yes, and And obviously now there are challenges for getting young people to read that I didn't have back in the 70s when we were kids. You know, there were three TV channels and no video games, no mobile phones. Whereas now there are many amazing things for young people to do. But there's still something incredible about that relationship that you have with a book. I think it just is nothing that can come close to that experience of reading. And I want that to be as wide as possible. The danger is with libraries closing that reading becomes an elite activity. Which I suppose to an extent it always has been, but you need that possibility that kids can get access to books. And the beauty about Barrington Stoke is that, well, I suppose they were initially, my publisher was set up to help people with dyslexia to read, but then it slightly widened to all reluctant readers, teenagers and younger. And I suppose that what I've tried to do is to keep that core audience of kids who don't read very much, but then also try and make the books attractive to the wider readership. And I suppose, again, that kind of feeds back to helping people who are reluctant readers, that what we don't want is to have this kind of ghetto of special books just for reluctant readers, because that can be quite embarrassing for a kid to go to the special bit of the library where it's only the books of people that aren't very good at reading. So I want them to be, I suppose, universal, but then have enough accessibility in them to encourage the reluctant readers.
And I know it's one of the things that the reviewers have really picked up on, and that adults love just as much as your young adult readers, that there's a real economy of language. There isn't a wasted word. They are a real pleasure to read in the same way that the short stories of Raymond Carver are, that you're not bogged down with somebody using adjective after adjective to describe the landscape. You just nail it in one or two words. Is it difficult to write like that? Do you constantly re-edit yourself?
Well, it wasn't natural for me. Most of my other teenage books, they're almost the opposite of that. They are quite elaborate, quite complex. They're full of metaphors, a lot of look-at-me type writing. When I started to write for Barrington Stoke, I had to force myself not to do that, to kind of pare it down and think about why do people really want to read. And it's for that, for character, it's for the plot, the stuff that happens, and then to get that setting as economically conveyed as possible. So I think it made me a much better writer, writing in this way. I had to go against the grain, my own natural tendencies towards excess. And just occasionally I let rip, so to speak, because I suppose a lot of my other books contain a lot of very graphic, over-the-top body comedy. It's one of the things that I kind of specialised in. And occasionally that leaks through. There's a bit of rather kind of gross clowning around in the books every now and then, which is why I kind of revert to my type in a way.
And I know that you love nothing more than taking your love of reading and of books into schools. Is there going to be a bit of a tour of Lark around the country?
Not quite a tour. I'm doing lots of events, particularly for World Book Week. It's always a very busy time for authors. It's more sporadic than an actual tour, but I'm doing lots of events. It's a privilege that writers for children have, which adult writers don't really have that chance to go into schools. And it's quite stressful, quite taxing. You've got to really be on your game. But there's nothing quite like making a hall full of 500 kids laugh. Or that intake of breath when you say something slightly shocking. It recharges the batteries, whilst also exhausting you.
Following your generously giving up your time to narrate the first three books in the series, can we tempt you back into the R&IB Talking Book Studios to narrate Lark?
I'm happy to do it. The only question is, can you find an engineer prepared to work with me again? Because I think it was quite stressful for the rather brilliant guy that engineered the last one with my constant stops to burp and stomach rumble. So I'd love to do it.
Did you enjoy it?
Enjoy isn't quite the right word. It was one of the most amazing things I've done, and it stretched me in directions I didn't really particularly enjoy being stretched, but it was hugely satisfying and fascinating as well. I kind of loved it and dreaded it at the same time.
Well, I'll look forward to seeing you again when you come back into the Talking Book Studios. I know that my wife picked up the copy of Lark that was lying around and began reading it and then didn't talk to me for the next couple of hours until
sorry.
She finished the book. So clearly you're entertaining people of all ages with your wonderful writing, and long may it continue. Anthony McGowan, thank you so much for coming back onto the show.
It's a pleasure, Ed. Great to be here.
Thanks to Anthony and his publisher, Barrington Stoke, Lark is already available in the R&IB Library in Braille and Giant Print, where it joins the other three books in this beautiful series, Brock, Pike and Rook, all of which are available in a full range of accessible formats. For more information on these and all of Anthony McGowan's other books, go to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
That's 0303 123 9999. And don't forget, if you've read a book that you want to talk about on the show, or found an author or narrator who you'd like to recommend to the other listeners, you can drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. You're listening to Read on RNIB Connect Radio. Coming up later, Angelique Hugh Ralph will be sharing the books of her life. But before that...
Five little bookworms hear a rumbly roar.
Grrr.
Smudge wasn't sure when the cave stopped being a cave and became a forest. But as she and Bartholomew walked further inside it, it became clear that the way back no longer existed.
Birds, he warbled. La la la, birds in cages. Very strong cages. Birds.
World Book Day is an annual celebration of the magic of books and reading. This year it falls on Thursday, March the 7th. And, as always, RNIB is proud to help the organisers in their mission to provide every child and young person with a book.
While Cab Pig was worrying what to do, a car screeched to a halt. A woman leapt out and made straight for Cab Pig.
A stray Dalmatian puppy!
OK, while I'm on the topic of scary stuff, I want to tell a story about something that happened a couple of years ago.
You've lost a lot of blood. You need to rest and replenish your fluids. You'll probably need a blood transfusion. Have you changed your mind about me calling for an ambulance?
From RNIB Library, here's Lynn Livingston.
World Book Day was founded in 1995 and is designated by UNESCO as a worldwide celebration of books and reading. And over 100 countries all across the world take part in it. Now, funnily enough, they all do it on a different day from us. They do it on April 23rd, which is Shakespeare's birthday. It's also Cervantes, who wrote Don Quixote. It's his birthday as well, and that's why they selected that date. However, because it often falls in the middle of our Easter holidays, we actually decided to do it at the beginning of March. So this year, World Book Day is on the 7th of March. Every year all across the country, schools are given tokens to hand out to every school child. And with these tokens, they can go into a bookshop or even a supermarket now, and there are a selection of books which are a pound. If you hand over your token, you're only going to be charged a pound to buy this book. And the idea behind that is there's an awful lot of children out there who don't have books. They don't have a groaning bookshelf in their bedroom. Some kids are very, very lucky to even get one book. And for those of us who have been taken to libraries since we were kids, who are given books for their Christmas and birthdays, we kind of take it for granted. But there's a lot of children out there who don't have reading as part of their life. Reading isn't encouraged in their lives. They don't have reading parents. So it's a way to get children involved. And in schools, it's lovely because often they allow the children to come in dressed up. So they'll come in dressed up as Harry Potter or Willy Wonka or something like that. So it's a fun day for them. But if they can come out of that with an interest in reading and actually have a book in their hand at the end, that's really important, something that they can call their own. About 4 years ago, we decided that it simply wasn't fair that sighted children were able to get their own copies, whereas children with sight loss weren't. If they had to read in alternative formats, they weren't able to get these range of books. So we decided to get involved in that, and we started producing the list, these £1 books. We started producing them in Braille and audio. And the giant print versions are available from Guide Dogs. So across the formats, they're covered. We work closely with World Book Day Charity. And as soon as they get the files for the books, they hand them over to us. And then we can turn them into alternative formats. So the EPUB file will be turned into Braille, or we'll hand it over to the studio and the studio will cast it and get somebody in to read it out for them. Both this year and last year have an audio import as well. The children's publishers, Dorling Kindersley, are doing their own version of the Lego Minifigure Mayhem book, which is lovely. So, and then they're giving it to us so we can have it in the library and we can include it as one of the books we can give away for free.
Four little bookworms think it's time to take some tea with Cinders and a charming prince. Now, there are three. Three little bookworms meet an alien crew. Zoing goes their spaceship. Now, there are two.
There is something for every range. There's one for the really littlies, the 0 to 4 range, which is 10 little bookworms, a very, you know, a short little snappy piece. Then we've got a couple of books for 5+. So we've got 101 Dalmatians. So it's a Cruella de Vil story. And the other one is Best in Show, which is a funny Claude the Dog story. So there's, you know, nice books for the younger kids involved.
Righto! Yelled Mr. Jack Russell. Let the dog show begin.
The first contest was the Best at Looking Like a Dog competition. Mr. Jack Russell looked at the dogs very closely in turn. Claude held his breath as the judge eyeballed Butch all over.
And then we move up to age 7+, and there we have a Lauren Child. Lauren Child, who is actually the Children's Laureate presently, has written a book called A Very Fishy Tale. The Lego Minifigure Mayhem book fits into that category. And also we have Bad Mermaids Meet the Witches. Mermaids and witches, how can you go wrong with that? That sounds like a great story.
Tiger skipped down the street with Fran the Fabulous Fairy flying beside her.
Mermaids are fabulous, Fran said, but not as fabulous as me.
I've never met a mermaid, Tiger said, but today is my lucky day. Tiger's best friend just happened to be Peggy, who was the top witch, and the top witch got to greet the mermaid queen. Peggy ruled all of Sinkville. She was 9, going on 10.
Then we move up to 9+. We have Rick Riordan, and he has written a Percy Jackson story specially for World Book Day, which is amazing. And then we have Frank Cottle Boyce, who's incredible. He's written The Great Rocket Robbery, and, you know, people will know him because his books have been turned into movies like Millions. And then we go on to Jeff Kinney, who, of course, is the Diary of a Wimpy Kid Guy, and he has written Diary of Greg Heffley's Best Friend. So if you know the books, you'll know who we're talking about here. So we get his diary as well.
After I got dirty from that hike, my dad said I had to take a shower. But Bampi's cabin is really old, and it doesn't have a shower. It just has one of those creepy old-fashioned tubs. So after I filled up the tub with water and got in, here's what happened next. I heard footsteps coming down the hall, and I thought it was my dad bringing me a towel or something. Clump, clump, clump. Dad? Then the door opened real slow, but there was no one there. And if you're thinking, oh, Rowley, it was probably your dad playing a trick on you, well, guess what? It wasn't. My dad was getting some milk at the store, and he didn't come back until like a half hour later. I told my dad what happened with the door, and he said it was probably just the wind. But I know what it was. The ghost of Bampi.
Bampi!
And then we move up to the teens. So there is something for teens this year. And we have the Mallory Blackman book, Not Forever. So this is carrying on the Noughts and Crosses story. And some people might know Mallory Blackman because she just wrote one of the new Doctor Who episodes. She wrote the Rosa Parks episode. So people might be coming to her from that. And there's another book called Snap as well in there, which is slightly more gritty.
Dan looks at me but doesn't answer. He gets the threat. So what were you? I ask. One of Macaulay's pawns? Or did the Dowds send you to Macaulay to do their dirty work? Whatever Macaulay didn't run in Meadowview, the Dowd family did. They're dark-skinned crosses, determined to get their slice of the Meadowview pie. And they're just as ruthless as Macaulay, carving their way up the status pole, one ruined and wrecked body at a time.
And then we've got a couple of Welsh titles as well. And we're doing the Welsh titles in all formats. So we're doing them in Braille, giant print, and audio as well. We have many, many, many Welsh language books in the library, but not for World Book Day, so that's very exciting. So if anyone is interested in getting one of the Welsh books, if they contact either the Cardiff office or they can contact the helpline as well. And all of these books can be got from the helpline. We're actually taking pre-orders right now. As we speak, there'll be somebody in the helpline taking an order. So if you are interested, if your own child or if you're a teacher and you have a child in your class that gets alternative format books from us, you can call up the helpline. All you have to do is to give the first name of the child and either the name of the school or if you are the parent's name, the title that you're looking for and which format you would like it in, whether you'd like it in Braille. And if it's for a younger person, you can either get the Braille in uncontracted or contracted Braille, or you can get it in audio as well. So just give us a shout and let us know which ones you would like. Everybody else in the sighted community has to pay £1 for their book. We give ours away for free. The reason we're able to do that is because we have an amazing sponsor this year. Last year, we were so successful. We were almost wondering how we were going to cope this year because every year we get more and more people. And of course, it does cost an awful lot of money to create these books and give them away for free. So our amazing fundraising department found a sponsor, and the entire World Book Day event for the RNIB is being covered by George Harrison's Material World Foundation, which is incredible. They've covered the transcription costs and the actual production costs as well for all the books. So we are so grateful to them. The actual event runs from the 28th of February to the 31st of March. As I said, we are taking pre-orders, but the books will be sent out from the 28th of February onwards. So as long as you get your order in between now and the end of March, don't worry, you'll be able to get your free book. And it's one book, even though there is a big long list of books, you get one book free per person.
Thanks to Lynn Livingston and everyone else at the RNIB Talking Book Studios and RNIB Library who've been involved in making this fantastic selection of books both accessible and available. To find out more about World Book Day at RNIB, visit the library website rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
It's not difficult to donate a little to RNIB. In fact, it's as easy as treating yourself to the latest CD, digital device, or Amazon Echo. Raise money for RNIB whilst you shop at Amazon. Amazon Smile is a simple and automatic way for you to support RNIB every time you shop, at no cost to you. When you next sign in to Amazon, use the address www.smile.amazon.co.uk and nominate RNIB as your charity of choice. The webpage looks exactly like amazon.co.uk and it remembers all of your login details, order history, wish lists, wedding lists, etc. But importantly, RNIB will receive 0.5% of the net sale of most goods that you can buy on the site. It's that easy to donate. Tell your friends and family how simple it is to donate to RNIB every time you shop on Amazon simply by using www.smile.amazon.co.uk. Treat yourself on Amazon and support your favourite charity while you shop.
Now it's back to Anjali Ralph to hear the books of her life. So, Anjali, was there a book that you read as a child that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
That's such a hard question because there are literally hundreds. So anything from Roald Dahl to C.S. Lewis. But I think the book that really captured my attention and made me feel as if I had a friend that I was suddenly discovering was Anne of Green Gables. So I got that as a present on my brother's birthday from an aunt who thought I was going to feel left out because he was getting a mountain of presents and I wasn't getting anything that day. So she bought me this book and I read it in 2 days and completely fell in love with Anne. I'm still in love with Anne. I've been searching for my Gilbert Blythe ever since. And that's one of my go-to childhood books that I absolutely adore. I can never get enough of.
It was broad daylight when Anne awoke and sat up in bed staring confusedly at the window through which a flood of cheery sunshine was pouring and outside of which something white and feathery waved across glimpses of blue sky. For a moment, she could not remember where she was. First came a delightful thrill as of something very pleasant. Then a horrible remembrance. This was Green Gables, and they didn't want her because she wasn't a boy. But it was morning, and yes, it was a cherry tree in full bloom outside of her window. With a bound, she was out of bed and across the floor. She pushed up the sash. It went up stiffly and creakily, as if it hadn't been opened for a long time, which was the case, and it stuck so tight that nothing was needed to hold it up. Anne dropped on her knees and gazed out into the June morning, her eyes glistening with delight. Oh, wasn't it beautiful? Wasn't it a lovely place? Suppose she wasn't really going to stay here. She would imagine she was. There was scope for imagination here.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery is available in Braille, giant print, and as TB 15396, narrated by Sarah Minnell. And is there a book that on a rainy day you'd like to curl up with and reread?
So it's a toss-up between The Hobbit by J.R. Tolkien, just because I loved the adventures as a child and I still love the adventure of, you know, the Bagginses and the dwarves and the hunt for treasure, and the Harry Potter books. So I tend to read those every summer without fail. As soon as 31st of July hits, I will read all seven non-stop till I'm done and I've had my fill of Hogwarts.
Do you have a particular favourite out of those?
It's between the first one, because that, you know, kind of drew you into the world, and also Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince, just because I think it was genius the way that J.K. Rowling went into the psychology of Voldemort and his history and kind of built up why it was that he became the way he became. So, yeah, it's those two books. But, you know, the first Harry Potter book just absolutely captures you from the first sentence, I think. So that's just a magical book.
The Dursleys had everything they wanted. But they also had a secret, and their greatest fear was that somebody would discover it. They didn't think they could bear it if anyone found out about the Potters. Mrs. Potter was Mrs. Dursley's sister, but they hadn't met for several years. In fact, Mrs. Dursley pretended she didn't have a sister, because her sister and her good-for-nothing husband were as un-Dursley-ish as it was possible to be. The Dursleys shuddered to think what the neighbours would say if the Potters arrived in the street. The Dursleys knew that the Potters had a small son too, but they had never seen him. This boy was another good reason for keeping the Potters away. They didn't want Dudley mixing with a child like that.
There were many paths that led up into those mountains and many passes over them, but most of the paths were cheats and deceptions, led nowhere or to bad ends, and most of the passes were infested by evil things and dreadful dangers. The dwarves and the hobbit, helped by the wise advice of Elrond and the knowledge and memory of Gandalf, took the right road to the right pass. Long days after they'd climbed out of the valley and left the last lonely, homely house miles behind, they were still going up and up and up. It was a hard path and a dangerous path, a crooked way and a lonely and a long. Now they could look back over the lands they'd left, laid out behind them, far below. Far, far away in the west, where things were blue and faint, Bilbo knew there lay his own country of safe and comfortable things, and his little hobbit hole. He shivered.
The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien and the entire Harry Potter series by J.K. Rowling are all available in a full range of accessible formats from the RNIB library. And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the Read On listeners?
So I'm currently reading a book by Trevor Noah, the comedian, called Born a Crime. And it's about his childhood and his upbringing in South Africa during apartheid. And it's just a really funny, humorous, very intellectual as well way of disseminating something that thankfully I didn't have to grow up in or that I didn't really experience in my childhood, but something that still has an impact in that part of the world and also in our psychology, I think, as a global community. And it's just a really funny, gorgeous book, which I would recommend. And I think he's actually bringing out a children's version now so that children can also learn how, you know, colonialism and racism were part and parcel of people's lives just, you know, a few decades ago. So absolutely fantastic read.
I grew up in a black family, in a black neighborhood, in a black country. I've traveled to other black cities and black countries all over the black continent. And in all of that time, I've yet to find a place where black people like cats. One of the biggest reasons for that, as we know in South Africa, is that only witches have cats. And all cats are witches.
Born a Crime, written and narrated by Trevor Noah, is available commercially in audio, ebook, and print. Anjali Ralph, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading and the story of the boy at the back of the class with the Read On listeners.
Thank you so much, Red, for having me.
Don't forget that you can share the books of your life by emailing us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. Alas, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all my guests and to everyone who's been in touch. Read On will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, why not subscribe to our podcast? We're available from all the major platforms, including iTunes, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or just search for RNIB Talking Books in your favourite podcast app. If you need any help, have any questions about the show, or just want to keep up to date with us, why not look for us on Twitter? I'm at Red Sail, that's REDSZELL, and producer Robert is at talking_books. So, farewell until next week, and don't forget to read on.